Okay, I'm going to open this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. What are we? Wednesday?
It is.
Wednesday, March 8th, 2017. Welcome, everyone. The topic of discussion today is going to be diesel engines. And we are going to start off. We have a few legislators in the room who are feeling the burn. And so we're going to bring them up right away to hear from them. And then we will walk through the bill for you. So Representatives Malmstrom, Nose, and Johnson, we welcome representatives into this room. Or we certainly tolerate them. And I think...
No, I did not get the memo.
Yeah. Oh dear.
Okay, so as you're sitting down, I'm going to actually formally open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1008. Do you need to tell us what it is?
Should we go in seniority
Great.
Order?
Okay, whoever wants to go first is welcome.
Who wants to start?
They can't decide.
Well, it's a special day today, isn't it?
Okay, I'll go first. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to allow me to provide testimony on Senate Bill 1008. My name is Sherry Malmstrom, and I'm a state representative from House District 27. That's from Beaverton and parts of Southwest Portland. Prior to being elected a state representative, I was invited to be a member of the work group that developed this legislation because of my background as a public health nurse. As a member of the work group, I wanted to be sure to give the perspective on the issue of public health when we in regards to diesel exhaust. People in high-density neighborhoods near freeways and where there's frequent congestion, think like Rose Quarter and on I-5, we know that diesel is a widely used fuel in our society. It is used on our highways by trucks shipping goods across the state. It is used by our communities, by passenger vehicles, buses in our downtowns, and is used to transport our children to and from school. Diesel-powered vehicles represent 29% of transportation fuel consumed in Oregon, but 60% of the particulate emissions. Whenever one of these vehicles idles or is in use in these high-density areas, they produce particles that are breathed in by whomever is around them. It is nearly impossible to avoid exposure to diesel exhaust in our day-to-day lives. If we live in an urban area, it's always there. If we live in rural areas, you can't escape them there either. As we breathe in these particles, they are getting introduced into our respiratory system and can make their way to our lungs. There are over 40 different kinds of air contaminants in this exhaust. These areas where there is frequent congestion and idling, such as the Rose Quarter, we have found a dramatic increase in respiratory diseases like asthma, and particularly in children. California and the American Lung Association have been doing studies on these contaminants since the 1990s and have found that individuals exposed to diesel exhaust are more likely than those not to have been exposed to develop cancer. Diesel exhaust contains many substances, including arsenic, benzene, formaldehyde, and nickel, and all these have been shown to increase your chances of cell mutation and makes individuals more likely to develop cancer. Senate Bill 1008 will help us reduce emissions of diesel exhaust in our communities, and in the long run, it will save lives. As a public health nurse, my biggest objective about learning about this issue was, what can we do to protect our children and our families from exposure to these contaminants? By passing Senate Bill 1008 is the answer. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Representative.
You want to go next?
Certainly.
Okay. Our second task force member, work group member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Mark Johnson, House District 52. I did also attend, at least attended in person or over the phone, most of the work group meetings over the course of the interim, and I found it to be an interesting experience. Obviously, there's a lot of interest in the public sector, in the private sector, and so forth. And what I'd like to just give you, I think, is some conclusions that I would have about the bill in front of you. And I'll be frank about it at the beginning, I would be testifying in opposition of Senate Bill 1008 as it is currently formatted. And I guess the biggest bullet point for me coming out of this process is that we simply need better data. We heard time and time again that we just don't have good data to be able to determine the causal effects of the particulate matters that so many here are concerned about. We need better air quality data in order to be able to make valid assumptions about the source of diesel particulate emissions. We frankly cannot say with certainty the source of high emission levels in affected areas. I would say, number two, modeling as a means of determining the sector contributions of airborne particulates is problematic and it's fraught with problems. California tried this, and they went and had all kinds of problems in terms of their modeling was off by a factor of, I think, 300%. They wasted a lot of money, took a lot of time that didn't have to be expended that way, and it just wasn't successful. Number three, beware of using the health model as the impetus for taking action directed at quote-unquote polluters. Without accurate data, there is simply no way to link one industry or sector of our economy as the prime causal agent to various health maladies that certain locations may be experiencing. Number four, Oregon has no EPA non-attainment areas for diesel particulate matters. We do have non-attainment areas for wood smoke particulate. And I'm going back to my environment committee here in a few short moments to talk about a bill that we're drafting that'll hopefully make some improvements in that area. But it's important to keep that in mind. We don't have that public health crisis that we do have in some other areas. Number four, a first step towards being able to quantify the sources of Oregon's diesel emissions would be to create an inventory of engines and of the sector throughout the state. Until we actually know the scope of diesel emission sources, we cannot effectively and fairly take actions to make reductions in emissions. Another point, one thing that we learned in the work group is that there is low-hanging fruit that could be taken advantage of to reach real reductions in emissions. I would point out that many of you are aware of the conversations that TriMet and PGE have been having about collaborating in the downtown area, about PGE providing the infrastructure for electrification of some of their fleet in the downtown area. Senate Bill 1547, we passed in February, makes this possible. If you combine that sort of collaboration with some amount of the Volkswagen diesel settlement resources, it could allow for significant reductions in key parts of the metro area that experience raised levels of particulates. It could serve as a pilot project and combined with rigorous monitoring provide us with some valuable data that we currently do not have. Another point is that school bus fleets are another area where real progress can be made relatively easily. And I would point out that Section 9 in the bill is valuable for that. Section 9 would simply extend the date for retrofits to be from 2017 of this past January 1st up to 2021. This is important because currently bus fleets across the state, school districts are caught in a pinch financially, as you well know. Those districts that would choose to have to purchase new buses to be compliant now could do so, but it throws off your replacement schedule for school districts. Generally school districts are on a pathway to incrementally do this. You get your reimbursement through ODE on the transportation subsidy and so forth, but if school districts would have to buy an abnormal amount of buses in 1 or 2 years, it's going to throw that retirement schedule off and it's going to create further problems down the road for these districts. So I strongly support Section 9 in this bill. So lastly, I guess just to sum up, Mr. Chair and committee members, I really believe this bill is an overreach as it currently is written. And it's not a conclusion that came from a consensus reached via the work group process. It will certainly create economic hardships for many Oregon businesses, and it simply is not backed up with sound data. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Nose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the work group, for the record, my name is Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which is inner southeast and northeast Portland. I want to thank you, Chair Dembrough, for your work on this issue, as well as other members of your work group. Please know that myself and my constituents have a lot of gratitude for everything you've done on this issue. And thank you all the members of the committee today for taking our time to hear this bill and our testimony. Diesel gas emissions, as we've heard, particulates are among the most toxic that humans are exposed to. It's an extremely small air particulate that can travel deeply into the respiratory tract and our lungs. And we know that relative to the state of Washington and California, we have some of the dirtiest diesel gas on the West Coast. Constant exposure leads to poor lung and heart health, and tackling this problem could lead to less asthma, fewer heart attacks, and help to keep public health and health care costs associated with diesel to be lower, to be down. I got interested in this issue when the bullseye glass air toxic situation happened in my district in February of last year. And while industrial pollutants and diesel are not exactly the same thing, in the process of learning to do what to do about industrial air pollution, I learned that diesel pollution is a long-standing problem and probably a more persistent problem. With regard to Senate Bill 1008, I'm particularly excited about the 1% for clean diesel. I think that's a solid approach to finding funding for the Clean Diesel Energy Fund, which is something we need if we're going to make progress on this issue. I'm also excited about the non-road inventory and registration provisions. If we're going to have data about that aspect of this, I think that's a good approach. I saw that there's a schedule for trucks with blanks. Hopefully we can figure out the emissions phase-in standards. And I think tackling the idling preemption is also a good idea. In terms of calls, emails, and in-person visits that I've had in my first term, I've had more about toxic air emissions, including diesel, than probably any other topic in the last year and a half because of growing awareness of the risk of diesel and other toxic air emissions and that what those pose to our families and our communities. I've spoken to parents, teachers, neighborhood advocates, and many others about this issue. And there really is just one common thread, and that is they're worried. They're worried about the impact these emissions are having on their children and our environment, and they're looking for us to take some kind of action. So please do what you can on this bill. Myself and others in the House are willing and eager to carry the baton should Senate Bill 1008 end up on our end of the building.
Thank you very much, Representative. Any questions for this panel? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much,
guys.
Three of you. Okay, now I'm going to present the bill together with Kevin Downing and Maureen, if you could come up as well.
So can I open a work session on a different bill?
Yeah, make it separate.
Yeah, exactly.
Chair Dembro, would you wish to start this panel?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Acting Chair. And let me say before I begin that Senator Olson had to go home ill, and that's otherwise he would be doing what you're doing, but we appreciate your doing it.
He'd probably be doing it better, but it's okay.
Great. So I'm Michael Dembro. I'm the Senator for District 23. That's Northeast, Southeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. And I'm very pleased at long last to bring before you Senate Bill 1008, which we're calling the Clean Engines Clean Air Act of 2017. And this bill is the product of the work group that has been meeting for the last 9 months or so. But I want to be really clear that this is not a product directly of the work group. It is informed by the work of the work group, and I think as you heard from the previous panel, there are some things, some elements that generated broad support, others not so much. But I will say, just speaking for myself personally, I learned an awful lot during that process, and I think it did really help to put together this bill, which is essentially a package of strategies to address this issue through a combination of incentives and standards to help us transition away from high-polluting older diesel engines. Because, as you know, I think you know, and we went into this at some length a couple of weeks ago when we had our meeting on the science of the health effects of diesel. The answer to the problem of diesel emissions is largely something that we have. Engines built after 2007, certainly 2010, are virtually free of particulates and other dangerous carcinogens, et cetera. The challenge, of course, is that diesel engines are very solid and long-living, and that's what we love about them. But it also means that those older engines are going to be with us for quite a while. And so this bill, Senate Bill 1008, is really designed to to the extent that we can, speed up that transition process to get the cleaner engines on the road. We heard testimony in the work group that the newer engines are, really virtually risk-free. And when I say the engines, I also, need to include retrofits to older engines. They too almost entirely remove the dangerous health effects. So I want to go over the main points of Senate Bill 1008. I won't be doing it in the order in which the bill is laid out, but I'm using a handout which is up on OLIS, or we have some copies in the back, called the Clean Engines, Clean Air Act of 2017. And with me here to be my lifelines and to answer questions are Kevin Downing from DEQ. I think of him as the Dean of Diesel. Some people call him the Duke of Diesel, but I prefer the term Dean of Diesel. And Maureen McGee, who has spent way too much of her life working on the drafting of this bill and other important ones. So the first element of the package relates to the Clean Diesel Engine Fund, which initially will be funded with dollars from the Volkswagen settlement. The Volkswagen settlement is something that was reached while the task force was meeting. It was very fortuitous for us because the settlement involved coming up with a sum of money to compensate for the deceptive practices that Volkswagen did, and a sum of money that would be directed at this very problem that we're trying to solve here of older diesel, dirtier diesel engines. We really were fortunate that we were already having these conversations as a task force. I know many of our colleagues around the country are suddenly, they've inherited their share of the settlement, and they aren't really prepared to, they haven't set the priorities for how to deal with those dollars, and there's concern that they're just going to sort of fritter them away. But I think we have a good blueprint for how best to use these dollars. The first tranche, as it were, or the first distributions, as you heard from Representative Johnson, would go to solving the problem of school buses. And, the legislature back in 2009 put out a mandate requiring all districts to convert to newer diesel technology by the year 2017 if they were going to retrofit their existing school buses, or by 2025 if they were going to replace them. We are actually at the point. We have the point where they had to retrofit has come and gone. And one of the elements of this bill, as Representative Johnson alluded to, would be to extend the timeline, the ability for school districts to choose the retrofit option. Because as the task force went on, we came more and more to understand the advantages of retrofits and the importance of having that as a tool that remains one that districts can use. We are extending that deadline to 2021, actually, in the bill. Now, the for subsequent distributions, the first principle that we intend to be used would be a place-based one, right? That is, it focuses on those parts of the state where there is a problem, areas of known health risk, and also high emissions. Frankly, we're looking at the more urban parts of the state where you have this confluence of high population, high vulnerable population, people who are at risk of health risks, and also a lot of diesel activity. So that'll be considered first, and then other factors would then be considered. The size of the fleet, I think there's largely interest in giving priority to smaller companies, those who are going to have the harder time transitioning. MWESB, you know, disadvantaged business enterprises, that they would be a focus, and also the ability of them to leverage outside dollars to help, so that these VW dollars would extend as much as possible. Okay, so that the use of the VW settlement to kickstart the Clean Diesel Engine Fund is one part of the bill. Another, and this directly addresses one of the issues that drew attention to our work was concern that older non-compliant equipment was coming into Oregon from other states, has or will, as those states are taking action here. And it seems to be a priority. It's a priority for us to stop this potential dumping of older polluting engines. And so what the bill would do is it would quickly halt the ability of fleet owners, both on-road and off-road, to buy non-compliant equipment, okay, and to increase the problem, as it were, of having the older engines in their fleets. The intention over time would be for them actually to reduce the number of older non-compliant engines in their fleets, both on the on-road side and the off-road side. And as was mentioned in the previous panel, right now we don't have a date set for when we would expect the existing fleets to divest themselves of their older engines. And that's conversations will continue around that with stakeholders over the next week or two, and we'll see where we wind up with that. Another element of the bill was alluded to is partnering with Associated General Contractors and ODOT. We are going to conduct an inventory of off-road equipment. This is something that would be done by July 1 of 2018 to get a snapshot of where are the off-road equipment deployed, and those of different horsepower and the size and the volume and where are they located. As was mentioned earlier, this was something that California did not do as they were working on their plan, and they did it after the plan was in place. We want to get it right and actually do the inventory up front. And so that is that's something that will happen. For the on-road, of course, we know where those engines are because they have to register with ODOT. I will just back up. I didn't say this, but for those, speaking of the on-road, for those companies, especially the larger ones that are doing business, that are doing multi-state kinds of transport, they are largely getting there. I think they're the percentage of those that are registered as multi-state, I think we may be over 70% of those, maybe even higher, are actually the newer engines. And that's not surprising. You know, they do a lot of miles. They have a lot of turnover. They are going to move to the newer engines just following the market, especially the larger ones. Where we still have a problem is those that do their business just in Oregon and are registered that way. This initial snapshot is going to really give us some important information, but we are, following up and, continuing to see how this effort is going, we're going to need the offside, the off-road people to register their vehicles, their engines, their off-road engines as well. And so the legislation anticipates creating a registration program for off-road equipment. It would be a nominal fee, ideally, something just enough to allow for the program to happen, to operate the program. And so the goal would be to have that begin in 2020. The next item you heard about before is the 1% set-aside of state-funded construction bond projects that would use public contracting to motivate faster turnover. And this is modeled after a proposal that AGC had at the national level. There was legislation that was attempted. Ultimately, the legislation did not pass. But the model is, we believe, a good one. So the way it would work is after, the bidding happened on a project, after the company that ultimately is awarded the bid would get the contract, then there would be an assessment of, is their equipment compliant? Is it clean? And if not, then 1% of the project allocation could be used to get them to get their to help them to purchase equipment that would be clean, and that would then, and then there are some requirements that they have to continue to use that equipment here in Oregon. It's a way of using the public contracting to drive the kind of behavior that we're hoping for. The other source of funding for incentives that we came up with is the federal CMAQ dollars. CMAQ are the congestion mitigation and air quality grants that come from the federal government, and they come to Oregon and then they're distributed. This was an idea that came to me sort of late in the game, I have to say, one of the attractive strategies that we discovered in the work group coming up from California was using state resources to provide loan guarantees for companies that were going to purchase new equipment. Loan guarantees are a great way to get a lot of bang for the buck, and we were initially hoping we could use VW settlement money for that. As it turns out, that you can't. That there are a number of really strict requirements on how you can use that VW settlement money. So the CMAQ funding, the idea would be that 1/4 of CMAQ money would be available for the Clean Diesel Engine Fund, and that could be used for grants and for loan guarantees. I will say that one of the things that really motivated me in this direction is that there are studies that show that using CMAQ dollars, and their purpose is for air quality improvements, using them for retrofits, diesel retrofits, and replacements and idling equipment are the most cost-effective use of those funds. If your goal is air quality. Now, having said that, that's not to say that the dollars that we're already getting from CMAQ aren't already being used, and there are a number of people that are attached to them. And I can tell you, I have heard from many of those people since the bill came out. And obviously, we're going to have to sit down those who have an interest in this matter and talk about this provision in the bill. So I just want everybody who's behind me and who's about to throw things at me to know that I'm very much open to having that conversation. And then finally, the last element of the bill has to do with idling. And I think everyone agrees that the more that we can keep idling to a minimum, Not only is that good business make good business sense, it's good for the environment, it's also good for public health. I have met with a couple of stakeholders, and I think we're on track to an agreement that would, I think, really improve our current idling regulation. It would, initially we were talking about just lifting the preemption, state preemption on idling. I think we have a way to go about it that would, where we would maintain the statewide program, but allow local governments the ability to provide guidelines for their local businesses of what, you know, they would like the businesses to ask their vendors to do. So that is something that's in play, and I hope we'll come to you with some amendments around that. So that is the bill in its entirety, I think, unless I left something out. And Maureen, is there something you'd like to add?
I don't think so. I suppose I could add. My name's Maureen McGee. I'm with a deputy with Legislative Council. Thank you for inviting me here. This is a very thorough outline of the bill. I guess the only thing that I would add is that under the existing Department of Environmental Quality Clean Diesel program, they're able to give grants and loans for replacements and retrofits of diesel vehicles. And this bill also allows for DEQ to give grants and loans for, or excuse me, retrofits and
repowers.
They currently can get for retrofits or repowers, and the bill would allow them to do replacements as well. So it extends that, and it also aligns those grant and loan provisions with the regulatory provisions, so that the incentives are going to be going towards the same things that people are required to do under the regulatory system. Just a small addition.
Yeah.
So, questions from the committee at all? I guess my first question would be on off-road. Is that any diesel engine, not just vehicles, or is it just vehicles?
It is not vehicles.
Okay.
Yes. So it would include it largely construction equipment. Now, I will say it will not include farm equipment and, I believe, logging equipment. The reason for that is that any kind of standards that we set for off-road equipment has to be identical to California's program. That's a provision that's in the Clean Air Act. And California has chosen, for good reasons, I think, to exempt farm equipment from their program. And so we would also be required to do so. Council McGee researched this issue quite thoroughly and gave us the clear message that whatever we do has to be identical to California, both in that if we were to set standards, they have to be identical to what California is at that point in time.
So along that same line, you have said that 2007, 2010, newer motors and the trucks and stuff, they're already compliant.
Right.
Is that true of these off-road kinds
yes.
of equipment?
Yes. So these are federal requirements okay. that require the higher standards since 2007.
So you wanted to get an inventory. Are you inventorying the new ones as well as the old ones? And would each of them have to pay for a certificate? Or do you just want the older ones?
So the inventory would use general fund dollars to do the inventory. The registration program, my sense would be that it would only apply to those that are, you know, that would be covered potentially by any standards. So it would not include farm equipment and the equipment that would be exempted. There's no reason for us to register those.
The newer ones, okay.
Well, the newer ones or the older ones.
Okay, that are exempt.
Right.
Okay. So Representative Johnson brought up the idea that we have areas of concern with respect to particulates. In particular, the places that exist now are all due to wood smoke. Is that true from DEQ's perspective? Or do we have some of these other areas that are that have been listed as concerns by DEQ and other areas?
So, Chair Roland, my name is Kevin Downing. I'm with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality.
Yeah.
And it's true, there are non-attainment areas in the state for particulate matter are primarily, the driving forces there are primarily wood smoke in many situations. Diesels also emit particulates, which may be contributing to an overall particulate problem. But diesel exhaust and particulates have a special focus that's not captured under the larger rubric of non-attainment status for particulates. And it has to do with the toxic nature of the particles that are emitted by diesel engines themselves, as distinct even from other sources like wood stoves. And that has to do with a combination of both the size of the particles from diesel engines are especially small, and the basically the chemical nature of the particles from diesel engines are primarily about 70% of the particles are carbon-based itself, which is also known as a toxic independent of itself. But the fact also is that these particles, by the nature of their construction, are also adsorb other toxics in the atmosphere and aggregate them so that you might have actionable levels of other toxics like benzene, which may be well-distributed gas, but otherwise are collected on the particle and the particles serve as a excellent transport mechanism, as it were, to move these toxics deep into the bloodstream as well as into the brain.
So have we identified any areas? I mean, we heard from Senator Dembro that urban areas, but have we truly identified that, the testing-wise, that those places are the places of concern?
Well, the best statewide inventory that we have is actually based on the National Air Toxics Assessment. The EPA does a screening assessment work nationally every 3 years. And so based on that and in comparison with the Oregon Health Benchmark for exposure to diesel for cancer risk that we're looking at, I forget the number of counties, but it's approximately 92% of the population is living in a county where they're experiencing exposure to diesel exhaust above Oregon benchmark levels.
Right. And Senator, if I could jump in, you know, if you'll recall the hearing that we had 2 weeks ago, we heard about the Portland air toxics study, and, you know, we heard sort of the cutting-edge research from OSU and OHSU, which, you know, really pointed to diesel being largely a place-bound problem. And they identified, you know, certainly the Portland metro area is an area of serious concern. You know, we heard from Dr. Lambert that the standards of what we hope for exposure to cancer is elevated there. So,
I will say
we had as a member of our task force Dr. Linda George, who's doing a lot of direct monitoring research at Portland State University, and the work that she's doing is feeding into the model. And, you know, as we heard last week, the model is constantly improving as a result of what we're doing with the monitoring. I'm sorry that Representative Johnson wasn't here for that report 2 weeks ago. I think it would have been informative.
I guess my last question, and I'll see if others have some, has to do with you have retrofits that can be done. There are companies out there that will put in ceramic filters, whatever necessary to do it. I know that in a couple of my large companies who were doing business in California, they were also looking at conversions to natural gas,
right.
Propane, all of those kind of things. Do those all meet the requirements of this bill?
They absolutely would, yes. And they're, you know, our intention for the VW settlement is that it's fuel neutral. I mean, it's the focus is on, you know, removing the health risks.
Senator Bert Sugar.
Thank you, Mr. Part-Time Chair.
Yeah,
just for the general from DEQ. Jet fuel is a kerosene-based fuel, too, just like diesel. Do we do we consider the jet engines, is that clean, is that be like clean diesel or unclean diesel, or is, what's the relationship? I mean, I've been spending a lot of time in airports, and there's a lot of a lot of takeoffs and landings at the Portland airport. So what's going on there?
So, Senator Betzinger, I'm not quite sure exactly how to answer that question. I think we need to look into that a little bit more. It's not from a compression ignition process like a diesel engine is. The fuel, as you may know, kerosene is oftentimes used in diesel engines as well. So to differentiate between the two, I'd have to actually get back to you. There's some more information about concerns about that.
And I did say it was my last one, but the other one came up. We have been trying to find generators of sufficient capacity to have on the coast in case of an earthquake. Many of them are diesel powered and
right.
having diesel fuels available. Would they all have to be refitted, or if we're buying an older one, because there are some of those out there that are being used?
So, Senator Roblin, I guess it would depend upon the nature of the program and how it's set up. There's oftentimes thresholds that are established in programs like this for standby generators. The department currently requires permits for generators that may operate above a minimum certain of our hours per year, and whether we carry that kind of a standard forward into the generator type systems that you're talking about would remain to be seen. And frankly, in this, there's also very likely the kind of situation that you describe is a 9.0 earthquake would be regarded as fairly a major disruptive event, and whether we're out there insisting on this, you know, rules that were adopted in a context that's quite different from that kind of a world that we're in, I think that's certainly I would suggest that might be a policy question that could be looked at more thoroughly.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Great. You're welcome.
Okay, so our first panel, let's have Matt Gillespie, Kerry Neeson, and Dana Jones, please. Right, Kerry, you want to start?
Sure, happy to.
Great, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough and members of the committee. Thank you so much for considering what I consider a very important piece of public health information, public health legislation before you today. My name is Kerry Neeson, and I have the great honor of working on policies and supporting issues that will protect the air of all Oregonians and make our air as healthy as possible for everyone to breathe. It's never a good thing when we can see our air. If you're driving behind a truck and you see a big black puff of smoke, or you see that what some might consider a beautiful shimmery aura coming out of tailpipes, it's never a good thing. It's never good for our health. I was talking to a physician yesterday, and I think she summed it up perfectly when she said, the only thing we should ever put into our lungs is clean, healthy air. So whether it's diesel exhaust or wood smoke or tobacco smoke, it's not anything that I want to put into my lungs, into your lungs, or the lungs of our youth. Our bodies have two great filters. We have the liver and we have the lungs. And when you think about it, our lungs are the only internal organ that we have that's constantly and consistently exposed to our external environment with every breath that we take. So what gets into our air gets into our lungs and beyond. The total surface area of an adult healthy lung is about the size of half of a tennis court. So when you think about it, that's a lot of surface area in our bodies that get exposed to our air. The good news is that our respiratory system does act as a filter and stops many particles from entering our body. Diesel engines produce ultra-fine particles. So the bad news is that these particles are small enough so they slip by the body's regular filters and they can travel deep into our lungs and enter the bloodstream where they cause the most damage, triggering heart attacks, asthma attacks, allergies, and bronchitis. Diesel exhaust is a toxic soup. Mercury, chromium, benzene, and other well-known toxins can hitchhike on these tiny particles, getting a ride deep into our lungs and into our bloodstream, causing cancer, especially lung cancer. These toxics can also lead to infertility, lung damage, asthma attacks, allergies, and infections. We're all at risk from diesel pollution, but especially at risk are our elderly, our children, people with lung diseases, those with diabetes, heart disease, and our poor. Children breathing bad air can actually limit their lung function for life. 80% of our lung growth happens after we're born, so exposing our lungs to bad air can really inhibit lung growth. Children are our most vulnerable. Exposure to these harmful toxics contribute to low birth rates and infant mortality. It's difficult to pinpoint the cause of cancers without long-term studies, but there's plenty of medical and biological evidence that diesel exhaust does cause cancer. In Oregon, diesel exhaust causes up to 460 premature deaths each year, causes up to $274 million in climate damage annually, and costs our state as much as $3.5 billion a year in harm and lost productivity. Diesel engine upgrades deliver a great return on our investment. It delivers about $17 in health benefits for every dollar invested, and it gives us all healthier air to breathe.
Thank you very much, Carrie. Dana, you want to go next?
Sure. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for having us here. My name is Dana Jones, and I'm here representing OPAL Environmental Justice Oregon. On behalf of OPAL Environmental Justice Oregon, we would like to express our support for SB 1008 and also request that the bill is amended to expressly include environmental justice communities into its text. As it is currently written, SB 1008 does acknowledge the legacy of disparate diesel pollution communities of color experience, and we thank Senator Denbrough for including that language. But SB 1008 fails to include environmental justice as a factor in identifying an area where diesel emissions are of the most concern. This identification must be made to combat the legacy of disparate diesel pollution in environmental justice communities. The disparate diesel pollution EJ communities face is the result of racist zoning and transportation infrastructure policy, lack of political power in low-income communities, and the failure of Oregon's decision makers to regulate air pollution and protect human health, instead kicking the can down the road by requesting additional data and claiming that the existing data is inconclusive. All of these actions and inactions lead to environmental justice communities bearing the brunt of the 460 excess diesel deaths Oregonians experience each year. Oregon has the sixth worst diesel pollution in the nation. Multnomah County, where OPAL's office is located, has worse air than Los Angeles. A 2014 analysis by the Multnomah County Health Department found that communities of color have a 2 to 3 times higher exposure to diesel than the already high levels that other Oregonians face. The environmental and health injustices that communities of color and low-income people have endured as a result of on-road mobile emissions have an opportunity to be addressed in this bill. We sincerely hope that our elected representatives will not pass up that opportunity. Centering environmental justice allows the diesel bill to protect the air for all Oregonians by protecting the most vulnerable and historically oppressed. Additionally, Oregon has unique tools for the implementation of environmental justice that can help achieve the goals of SB 1008. ORS 182.538 establishes the Environmental Justice Task Force, which can help identify environmental justice communities and address the unique challenges these communities face from on-road diesel emissions. ORS 182.545 establishes an environmental justice citizen advocate position for natural resource agencies like DEQ. And if this position is properly funded and staffed, it can be a conduit between environmental justice populations, regulated entities, and the government. Choosing to omit language that includes environmental justice in SB 1008 would also be choosing to forfeit both of these resources, which the legislature enacted for the precise purpose of addressing issues like air pollution in communities of color and low income. OPAL has participated in Senator Dembrough's diesel work group and in countless hours of discussion around on-road diesel leading up to this hearing, and is enthusiastically supportive of the provisions contained within this bill. Specifically, the repeal on anti-idling laws is a critical step that this legislature must take. Doing so will reduce deaths, excess cancer risk, asthma, low birth rates, and respiratory illness caused by diesel pollution. On February 26th, upon seeing the first draft of this bill, we advised that environmental justice communities must be explicitly included into its text, because choosing to target sensitive population is broad and amorphous language that will not protect communities of color and low income, but instead will result in communities that have the most political power and lobbying ability to claim that they are the most disparately affected by this diesel pollution. We all know the NIMBY phenomenon, the effect that it has on EJ communities. This bill must be amended to include and center environmental justice communities into its text. Once these changes have been implemented, SB 1008 will be a long overdue and welcome change that protects and values human health here in Oregon. OPAL strongly supports the passage of this bill, and we encourage you to delay only if you intend to include explicit language regarding environmental justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Dana. Nick?
Thanks. So good afternoon, Chair Dembrough and the members of the committee. My name is Matt Gillespie, and I'm the Healthy Communities Coordinator at the Benton County Health Department. I'm here today on behalf of the Coalition of Local Health Officials, or CLO, which represents the 34 local public health departments in Oregon who work to protect the public's health. CLO supports SB 1008 and encourages the committee to take action on this important legislation. The Coalition of Local Health Officials supports this legislation as it creates standards for both on-road diesel fleets and off-road diesel engines, and incentive programs that will accelerate the cleanup of dirty diesel engines in Oregon. Diesel exhaust comes from multiple sources, including trucks and school buses, and is made up of fine sooty particles and more than 40 hazardous substances. Exposure to diesel exhaust causes cancer, increases risk of heart attack, stroke, and cardiovascular disease, exacerbates asthma, and can lead to low weight and preterm births. Oregon's 34 local public health departments work to create opportunities for health by protecting Oregonians from the spread of disease and working to support new moms and babies on a pathway to lifelong health. Research shows that the first 1,000 days of a child's life are the most important, and early life exposure to diesel pollution can create challenges in the brain that raise the risk of neurological disease later in life. Research has also shown that children who live within 500 meters of a major highway show substantial lung deficits, and exposure to air pollution is the number one cause of child hospitalization, child chronic health condition, and chronic illness causing school absences. Furthermore, addressing diesel pollution is not only a health issue, but an equity issue as well. People in poor and non-white neighborhoods are more likely to be exposed to diesel exhaust pollution. And in Oregon, both asthma and heart disease are more prevalent in low-income neighborhoods. Oregon is falling behind in protecting everyone in our state from deadly diesel pollution. Diesel pollution puts 90% of the people in Oregon at risk for cancer, and as these two also said, it causes up to 460 premature deaths each year. The single biggest return on investment for diesel upgrades is saved lives and avoided health costs. The health of Oregon's children and families is priceless. If we do nothing, Oregonians will continue to have diminished health from diesel pollution for decades. The Coalition of Local Health Officials urges your support of SB 1008. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Matt. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one. You had some facts. I think there was 450 premature deaths. Where do you get that information, those statistics from?
I'd be happy to give you that citation. I don't have it in my head right now, but I was looking at that report this morning, so I'm happy to forward that to you.
Yeah, just make sure my office gets it. I'd like
you
to
bet.
See that. There's a couple other ones with heart disease and some. I'd like to see where that information comes
okay.
from.
Okay, I'm happy to do that. I'm sorry I don't have that for you today.
Thank you.
I will say there is a lot of material posted on OLIS now, and also from our meeting from 2 weeks ago that I think addresses a lot of this. Okay, thank you all three of you.
Thanks.
Okay, let's have Bob Russell, John Rakowitz, and Mike Eliason, please.
Did you just call on me?
I didn't, but I will, Mike. Actually, I mean, it might make sense for you to. No, I've been told you're going to be later. So.
John's so, X that.
So if you could remain patient, Mike.
Okay, I'm sorry. I just misheard something. That's all.
No, it's fine. Okay, Bob, you want to start?
Well, John, I think we're going to start. No, go ahead. It's fine. Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. And my testimony is posted on OLIS, and so I'm going to be fairly brief in deference to all the people back here that want to testify, and I'm here every day. And if you have questions, you can catch me at any time. We've been talking about the health effects of diesel in this building for at least the last decade. And it's also been a ongoing discussion at the national level. And the Federal Environmental Protection Agency required that the trucking industry reduce the NOx emissions from our trucks beginning in 2004. And then in 2007, they required that we reduce the particulate matters. And we reduced the particulate matter at that time by almost 98%. And then in 2010, we had a further drop in the NOx. Matter of fact, there was a study, and 2 weeks ago, you had Perry Heistad was here testifying before you, and he mentioned the Health Effects Institute study that concluded that there is no link between cancer and the emissions from a 2007 diesel truck. So with the new trucks, we don't have the health impacts. The issue clearly is the legacy fleet, as we refer to it, and the older vehicles. So how many trucks do we have that are older? And on the first page of my testimony, there's a little chart. In state, right now, we've got about 53% of the trucks have 2007 or newer engines. And that's for a total of 46,599 trucks. The bigger fleet is from out of state, and that's 292,489. And 85% of those have 2007 or newer engines. So the total, we've got 80% of the trucks operating in Oregon. And this is the trucking industry. This is the for-hire segment. 80% have 2007 or newer engines. I got some data late last night from ODOT on trucks between 10,000 and 26,000 pounds, the little delivery trucks. And as of right now, 75% of those vehicles have 2,000 or 7 or newer engines. So we've made some tremendous strides since 2007 in adopting the newer, cleaner technologies. So the question remains is what is the appropriate response to deal with the legacy fleet? California is the only state that has a regulatory program that deals with diesels. Every other state that is concerned about diesels have incentive programs, but not regulatory. It is totally understandable why California has a regulatory program, quite frankly. They have significant parts of the state, from Los Angeles to the Mexico border on the south coast, and the entire San Joaquin Valley are EPA non-attainment areas for particulate matter, what's 2.5 microns, which is normally associated with diesel vehicles. When you look at the same data, EPA data for Oregon, there are absolutely no non-attainment areas in Oregon. The most recent stuff, which is attachment 5 in my handout, shows that continues. And there are a few places in the country, with California leading the pack, where they have significant areas of non-attainment for PM 2.5. In 2007, which was really the first year that we had a serious discussion about diesel here, we passed the original Clean Diesel Bill. And the coalition that passed that bill was my organization, the Oregon Environmental Council, and the Oregon chapter of the American Lung Association. The idea that was it's an incentive-based program. Matter of fact, Senate Bill 10,008 modifies that old legislative language to create some more flexibility. Since 2007, we have put zero state dollars into that program. Kevin Downing, who you met earlier, has been able to attract $4.3 million in federal funds since for the 10-year period to help people upgrade their diesel vehicles. In contrast, California has spent hundreds of millions of dollars in incentives, and they spent the incentives and helped people upgrade their diesels before they implemented the regulatory program. Our neighbor to the north, who does not have a regulatory program, has spent over $80 million in helping people get into the newer vehicles. We do have the Volkswagen Fund, which you've heard about. It's about $83 million. We do not expect, quite frankly, that that is going to be of any assistance to the trucking industry. If that money's targeted so you get the biggest bang for the buck, you're going to first do school buses, and then you're going to do other vehicles that operate a lot more miles in a given geographical area than we do. So the $83 million is not going to upgrade all of the diesel vehicles, and particularly if you start considering the off-road engines, it won't touch that at all. So what do we think that we ought to do going forward? We think that there's some principles that we ought to adhere to. Number one, and Senator Dembrough mentioned it, is that the program should be targeted geographically, no matter what kind of program it is. I mean, it should be targeted to those areas where there is a higher level of emissions, particulate matter emissions. We also think that the selection of those geographical areas should be based on monitored data rather than computer models. Oregon has struggled in funding.
Fire alarm.
Great.
Okay, I'm resuming the public hearing on Senate Bill 1008. Sorry for the disturbance, Bob. I don't know what it was that you said, but whatever, it worked.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell for the Oregon Trucking Association, for the record. I don't know what I said either. It was a signal for me to hurry up.
Yeah.
So the next point that I was making is that whatever we do, we need to have monitored data. Oregon has traditionally underinvested in monitoring equipment, and it's not just to determine where we need to focus, but once we develop a program, we need to measure to make sure that it's effective. And without good data, we're not able to do that. The last document in my testimony is a description of DEQ's current monitoring efforts. And I'm asking that you and everyone else help support DEQ in getting additional monitor equipment and get that portion of their budget be adequately funded. The program resources should be expended in such a way that provide the largest cost benefit possible. That seems like a no-brainer, and that's why I said earlier that I don't expect that any of the Volkswagen settlement money will come to the trucking industry, because I do believe that there are other vehicles that are older and that operate more miles in the affected areas, that money should go to them first. We need to get the biggest bang for the buck and reduce the emissions. We would like to maintain our statewide idling program, although we are aware that there are things that can be done to modify that program and perhaps make it even better, and we've been having discussions with Multnomah County AGC and Senator Dembrough, and I think that they've been very productive so far. So finally, I want to thank Senator Dembrough for the work group that we all participated in for the last 9 months. I think it dramatically increased people's knowledge level about diesels and where we are and what we could do to best address the remaining issues. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Bob. Mike, John?
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. John Rakowitz with AGC Associated General Contractors. Bob has, I agree with everything Bob said on the on-road side. I have the task to deal with the off-road side, which is an entirely different story. And the most important part of that story is we know virtually nothing about the inventory, public, private, doesn't matter. We have no information base. So I have to start with going on the record. We have no choice but to oppose this bill, in particular that off-road diesel section proposed in Section 19. I've also submitted testimony. We have issues around the way the public contracting requirement is outlined in Sections 1 through 6 and the registration requirement in Sections 13 through 16. But happy to answer some questions there. I think there's a difference between the way Senator Dembro described in his testimony earlier. That's a model that we can talk about, but the actual model and the way it's written in the bill is not something that we could see ourselves supporting. And so this bill for my industry, sort of at the heart of it all, and nobody ever quite says it, is the construction industry. That's what it's really about. It's almost impossible because of the lack of information to actually calculate what kind of cost it would have to our industry. So let me just talk about the due diligence. And I also want to thank Senator Dembro. I do think we were forced to learn a lot in a hurry about a very complex set of issues. And we've been at it for about a year, our industry has. Doing our due diligence. We don't lightly oppose a bill like this, but we've dug in, and so here's what we've learned that I think it's really important to understand how it impacts the off-road side of this, not the on-road, because the story is so different. First, here's what we really learned is California made huge mistakes. 14, 15 years ago when they went to work, they did one thing really well up front. They put hundreds of millions of dollars into incentives to try to help industry get there. They did not get there. And as Senator Dembro, as Mr. Russell has pointed out, they had huge non-attainment, EPA non-attainment areas to deal with. They had huge, recognized by the federal government, emissions issues, unlike Oregon. We do not have that. So what they did was, based upon EPA modeling, they made some assumptions about what construction in particular was emitting, what that industry in California was emitting. After a lot of money, a lot of trouble, a lot of effort, California had to acknowledge, CARB, California Air Resources Board, acknowledged publicly many years ago that they had overestimated the emissions the construction industry that the construction industry was responsible for by a margin of 340%. I want to repeat that, 340%. The really sad part about it was, in acknowledging that, they also acknowledged that the caps, that the regulation that they had put in place for off-road equipment, in particular construction, the industry had already met the caps. There was, in fact, no need whatsoever to put in place a regulatory program. Oops, too late, the law's in place. So our number one message today is please do not go down the road of bringing into Oregon something that was unnecessary in the state of California and that, as Senator Dembro pointed out, Federal Clean Air Act only allows you to put in place the particular schedule and approach that they use in the state of California, in Oregon. That is the only state in the union allowed to craft a particular program. So that's our number one message. We'll see what else I really want to get on the record, not take up everybody's time. So what can we support? And that is an inventory. In fact, I want to urge you, there is a bill, Senate Bill 971, that I hope this committee will hear sometime soon. It gets at some of the uses of priority uses of the VW settlement money along the lines and the principles that Bob earlier outlined, but it does a second part. It outlines exactly what off-road inventory would look like. We believe it needs to be a third party. so that all parties in this room, everybody who has a different point of view in this, can have confidence in the information. We think it needs to be a substantial investment that has to be made up front, and we will advocate for that in this session. Without that, we have no way of actually calculating how much are we talking, hundreds of millions of dollars, or are we talking more than that? The impact of off-road regulation would mean, and I want to point out to everybody, I think it's sometimes forgotten, the construction industry in Oregon is homegrown. It is a bunch of family-based, homegrown businesses. It's not a big bunch of giant corporations that have the kind of capital that I think sometimes people imagine our industry has. It doesn't. It's a bunch of small mom-and-pop type businesses. So you can imagine if you simply outlaw certain equipment or devalue equipment because that equipment can no longer be used in Oregon, the ability for those companies to recapitalize and or simply stay in business is actually going to be threatened. So for that reason, we hope that this session will do something it hasn't done before, which is make that significant investment. A few months ago, DEQ actually sent out an RFI, reported that out to the work group. It's a significant investment that is going to be necessary. Somewhere in the order, in our view, given what the responses that DEQ got back about what the cost of an inventory would look like, is $250,000, $300,000. And I am saying here for the record that we're going to support that and aggressively pursue that, because from there we believe we can look at and shape whatever policies may be necessary related to our industry and in general, and be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Mike?
Yep. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, Michael Eisen with the Association of Oregon Counties. Thanks for the opportunity to comment briefly on this. I think once you get beyond the very worthy goals that are stated by the proponents and yourself, it quickly becomes clear that this is one of the most challenging sort of regulatory endeavors that we have. The good news is that this may be one of the rare sort of climate and health issues that actually, as you stated earlier, is actually improving over time and will continue to improve. Consider that per the EPA, there's been a 34% reduction in black carbon between 2000 and 2013, and the EPA projects an additional 86% decline by 2030. More impressive when you consider the overall vehicle miles traveled since 1980 has increased by 95%, and the population of the U.S. has increased by 39%. So it is an issue that is going to resolve itself, understandably. As stated earlier, the goal is to speed up that timeline. Challenge to do that, of course, is to not financially cripple public agencies that have financially constrained budgets, as well as contractors who work on public and private projects. To speak specifically to some of the concepts outlined in the bill, we're very supportive of the VW settlement funds getting the highest and best use. The goal, I think everybody agrees, is to get the biggest, as Bob said, biggest bang for the buck. And that includes targeting, I think, the most impacted areas, which is clearly certainly the Portland metro area and other very dense urban areas around the state. Certainly Portland has many interstates and highways traversing the area, as well as disadvantaged populations that are located close to that. Done correctly, we're also supportive of a statewide inventory to gather much-needed information on how much old equipment is still in use, how often it's used, as well as supportive of, as both folks have said, or gentlemen here have said, increased state incentives that to date have never been put forth over the last decade. Specific to a couple other sections of the bill, however, we are very opposed to the pulling 1% out of contracts, the registration program that S spoken about earlier. We know it costs an incredible amount of money to administer in the state of California, as well as probably most significantly the adoption of a California phase-in. We surveyed numerous county public works departments on the fiscal impact of replacing the diesel equipment in their fleets that still has useful life left in it. Estimates range from $200,000 in Lincoln County up to $1.7 million in Josephine County, most counties closer to the latter rather than the former. And this is money that would not be going toward maintaining a road system that is noted in the ongoing transportation talks has already fallen behind because of disinvestment and increased costs. So we'll cut to the chase and wrap up there, but happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Just a question about the 1%. So if we don't get the money there, what do you have an alternative proposal for how we can generate funds that your organization would support?
Well, I think right now we're looking at both the settlement dollars and a really a wish for state contributions in the name of whether it's general fund or others. But
clearly we face general fund challenges. So, and you know, that's partly why we're looking at our capital dollars. Which, I mentioned the 1%, and the goal is to have our 1% program, John, similar to the national one that was proposed. That's where that model came from, as well as we know that there are some jurisdictions that set aside 1% of public projects for art purposes. That was also kind of the model here. And it seemed to make sense to use public contracting to help, especially those smaller companies, the MWESBs, that we all want to make sure are able to compete fairly. This as a way to help those small fleets.
Chair Denbrough, one note on that. I will say that. One thing that was a piece of, I think, believe the 2015 proposal as well. And then during the life of the work group, which was a very, very enlightening work group, I don't think we ever really got to the bottom of how many contracts this would apply to, how much money would be raised. I'm not sure those items really ever came out during the course of the work group. And I'm frankly still not sure if we know. Just one note on that.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for these gentlemen? Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
John, I thought I heard you say that you had posted some material. I've looked, I didn't see it, so I'm not sure if you actually got it.
I apologize. It will be posted shortly if it hasn't already. It's just simple testimony. It's my actual testimony. It's not got a whole lot more information. The story is the same. The position's the same. I apologize for that, but it will be posted. We've sort of been scrambling to get ready for this hearing.
Okay.
I apologize.
Do you know if the material covers anything about health cost impacts for workers? Have your industry have any data on how they're protected, what steps are taken, or how many health claims have been caused?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Brzezinski, it does not. I don't think we have any of that kind of data. The only health-related issue that we know about, and we rely a great deal on either California or National AGC, simply because we don't have data that kind of capacity here. But I do know there were safety issues raised around certain kind of retrofits because of line of sight issues. So we do know about that. But other than that, there's really no data. Not that I know of, either on the labor or management side. So it's not been an issue that has been raised to our knowledge.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Great. Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. Let's move to the next panel, which is Alan Sprott, Paul Lewis, and Sharon Myron, please, Commissioner. Later.
Okay.
Commissioner, I know you're on a tight timeline. Do you want to go first?
Does it matter?
Okay.
I'm going with that guy back to the county, so thank you. We're stuck.
I'm up.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Chair Denbrough and committee. My name is Alan Sprott, and I'm Vice President of Environmental Affairs for Vigor Industrial. We own the shipyard on Swan Island where we repair, overhaul ships and build marine equipment. We also own a fabrication facility in Clackamas where we build complex aluminum and, and steel structures. So I'm here just to say that we strongly support legislation to deal with diesel particulate emissions. My company at our shipyard in Portland started a program a couple of years ago to address some of the emissions from our facility. So, for example, we are already rotating out all of our older diesel-powered rolling stock and replacing it with new equipment. And we also have a policy in our yard where we require our customers to cold iron, which is basically to shut down their diesel generating equipment and their power plants and go on shore power. And we have done that for a couple of reasons. One, to make a better safer work environment for our employees and reduce the contributions from our facility to the local airshed. We think that's important for a couple of reasons. One, we want to maintain our status as an attainment area in the Portland airshed for diesel particulate. That's good for our business to stay in attainment. But also I've heard reference to the Portland Air Toxic Study, and when we've looked at that, we see that diesel particulate is in the top five of pollutants in the airshed that are causing health risk. And so that is a concern to us, particularly since both of our facilities in Clackamas and at Swan Island have air quality permits, and we are now engaged in the clean air program where we're producing information to DEQ. And we fully expect that from that effort there will be additional air quality regulations that are imposed on our facility, yet when we look at our emissions, none of those even make the list of the pollutants that are causing problems in the airshed for Portland and the Portland Air Toxic Study. So there seems to be a disconnect there. If we're addressing air quality issues, we need to bring in the ones that are at least in the top five. For us, there's a substantial body of evidence that there are health effects associated with diesel particulate emissions. It sounds like your committee has been fully vetting that. For me personally, I have a child that's been affected by with a disease that is associated with particulate matter, and so it's not only important to my company, but it's also important to me personally. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Spratt.
Great. Thanks.
Mr. Lewis, welcome back.
Great. Nice to be here. Thanks, you, Chair Dembro, and members of the committee. My name is Paul Lewis. I'm the Multnomah County Health Officer, and I'm also the Tri-County Health Officer in the Portland metro area. I'm also a practicing pediatrician, and I've been serving on the Cleaner Air Oregon Advisory Committee. So I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1008. I think it will prevent chronic disease caused by dirty diesel emissions and address longstanding health and social inequities borne by low-income Oregonians and communities of color. As a pediatrician, I'm particularly passionate about protecting children and pregnant women from unnecessary exposure to pollution. I did my medical training north and south of here, and as I've learned in the last 12 months, like some people that have already mentioned, starting with the glass factories and the cleaner air and everything else, that I was a little disappointed that the state that I'm living in now, where I'm raising my children, has the weakest policies on limiting exposure to diesel particulates. There's at least three kids, I have three kids. There's at least three reasons. At least three reasons why I got to get home.
Reasons.
No.
Yeah.
Three reasons why kids are particularly vulnerable, and you've heard some of this before. They're little, and they breathe a lot. They're like hummingbirds. They breathe a lot. Their lungs are small. A lot more of this stuff gets in there. We know a lot more about cancer now than we used to. It's basically a very, very long-term disease. You get exposed to a lot of stuff in your life, and when you're exposed early in life, there's a lot more decades for those changes to your cells to happen, leading to cancer. Finally, it's sad to report, but you guys know this. Most kids in Oregon are poor. About half of the kids are born into the Oregon Health Plan, right? So kind of by definition, they live in the neighborhoods that are most heavily affected by pollution of all kinds, and including diesel. So again, I feel like that's an obligation that we have to address. I also have a big county, almost 800,000 residents, and by far the greatest concentration of mobile traffic, as well as shipping, rail, et cetera. So this is particularly important to me that we do, as I've been saying, grab this gold ring, and we've been waiting a long time for it. So I'm here, obviously, in strong support of this bill. I know it's very complicated. I'm certainly not an expert on all of the subtle policy details,
But I went back to do more medical training just a few years ago in a field called preventive medicine, and that's really where the bang is. We should be preventing diseases, not treating them. So thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you. So Chair Dembro and members of the committee, my name is Sharon Myron, and I am Multnomah County Commissioner for District 1. I really appreciate the opportunity to come before you today in strong support of Senate Bill 1008, which will accelerate the cleanup of dirty diesel engines through a mix of standards and incentives. Some of what I say will touch on what others have said before, but hopefully it will reinforce some of those points. In addition to serving as a county commissioner, I'm also an emergency room doctor. I practice at Kaiser in Clackamas County. And as an ER doctor, we're often on the front line of public health crises and issues. We saw the mental health crisis before others knew it was a crisis. We see the opioid epidemic before it became a crisis. And in the ER, we see the effects of these of diesel pollution on people. So make no mistake, this is a public health issue for certain. We've heard how diesel pollution contains heavy metals. It contains all these toxins, and they're so small that they are breathed into the lungs. They lodge deeply in the lungs. They can transfer through the lungs into the bloodstream, and the results at this point are not hypothetical. They really do contribute to diseases. Asthma, clearly severe, they exacerbate asthma, chronic lung diseases, heart attacks, et cetera. They also are shown to cause premature death. I do see coming into the ER the real human impact of these diseases, and I understand that you have a child that's affected by this. I have seen people come in severe respiratory distress. I've had to intubate, put breathing tubes down people's into people's lungs to help them ventilate, and it's a very scary thing to see. And we see it more and more. Children are especially vulnerable, as has been pointed out. Their lungs are still developing. They're little. They breathe. They're like hummingbirds, as was said, and so they circulate a lot more of these toxins, and they have a much more significant effect. I'm used to treating people coming into the ER in crisis, but this problem is systemic. So I'm here today to be an ER doctor trying to help treat the problem on a systemic level. As we know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And from a fiscal standpoint, we've heard earlier that there is quite a substantial financial impact on the health problems, impact of the health problems caused by diesel pollution. So they're enormous. They total $3.5 billion annually in Oregon. So this is not a hypothetical cost. This is the real cost of these pollutants. The county where I work does see particular evidence of the health problems. We are a hot spot as a whole. But I also do want to be clear and really emphasize that this is a problem that disproportionately burdens of people of color in Multnomah County. In 2014, Multnomah County Department of Health conducted a study of racial and ethnic disparities, found that communities of color in the county were exposed to levels of these toxins, diesel pollution, 2 to 3 times more than their white counterparts. These communities are more likely to live in poverty, more likely to be affected by institutional racism and other injustices. Cleaning up diesel pollution is not just a public health imperative, but an environmental justice imperative as well. So the good news is that we have a solution for the diesel pollution. We have the technology to filter diesel particulate matter and keep it out of the air. I strongly urge you to take action and grab this golden opportunity and pass Senate Bill 1008 to clean up the dirty diesel in Oregon. through a rational combination of enacting the standards and adopting incentives to meet those standards. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify before you here today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Sharon. Senator Roblin.
Yeah, the only question I have is that having heard testimony that we have since 2007 cut down the amount of these particulates, are you saying that there are more kids now affected than there were 10 years ago when there was a lot more cars and trucks using these? You would think it would be going down if, in fact, the particulates are going down. I know that in California, they had a big spike of asthma and all that stuff before they got into their regulations, so that it has gotten better.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like the way you're talking about that it's a crisis now, as opposed to it wasn't a crisis when there was a lot more diesel in the air.
I think it wasn't a crisis with a lot more. It has been a continuing crisis. I do see it. We also are seeing higher temperature. You know, we're seeing some of the other environmental contributors that really exacerbate the effects of these pollutants. So that, I think, is also a contributing factor. But even though we may be going down somewhat, the levels are still really high. So we're seeing a lot of this.
Dr. Lewis.
Yeah. Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, I think it's always complicated. For example, we recently had a big change in Portland with some of the containerized shipping changing and more things going by rail, which leaves a lot more of probably the shorter haul trucks running around. I mean, I happen to live in southeast Portland right near the rail yard with all the trucks coming and going, and that traffic has really spiked in the last year because of some shipping company thing. We've also had a large population increase and much greater congestion, and that exacerbates it because it's not only more vehicles, they're not moving very fast as well. So I don't know if we have exact numbers. There's also greater appreciation almost every year of the more obvious and less obvious toxic effects of these small and even subcellular sized particles. So again, that leads to my concern of we always have incomplete data. We heard a lot about that. But I hope that we can still see through the haze and do what we can to protect people.
Yeah. Great. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next up we have Larry Gesher, Mark Landauer, and Cody White. And then we'll get to you, Mike, on the phone. And Michael Strikespear as well. Hey, Larry, you want to kick us off?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Dembro and committee, for giving me the opportunity to come and speak for you. My name is Larry Gesher. I own a small, heavy civil construction company located about 13 miles east of here in Staten, Oregon. I was an emerging small business starting up. Been in business for 3 years now. I employ 24 people. I was also a member of the work group that participated and went through the process of trying to figure out a solution to what we consider a problem in Oregon. I guess as an individual going through that, obviously knowing what California went through, seeing that the EPA model produced a problem that was exacerbated by 340% of what it actually was, I guess the only way to get at the true problem here is to figure out if we have a problem, and that's through an inventory. And it's not an inventory just of construction diesel equipment, because that tells us nothing. It's a true inventory of all the diesel engines in the state of Oregon. So we can take that data and put that information into the models and find out, do we meet the Oregon benchmark or not? And right now, the way the bill is written, we go get an inventory, but we do nothing with it. And so I guess I don't quite get why we go get an inventory if we're not going to take that information and put it into the models and look and see, do we have a problem? We've jumped to the conclusion that we have a problem just because a model tells us that we know the models was off by 340% in California. And so I guess that's my big thing as far as the model. I mean, as far as inventory, we're for an inventory, but the inventory needs to be used when it's put together. Currently, as SB 10008 is written, if passed, you will kill small business in the fact of, for one thing, you'll never have a small business in heavy civil startup, because it's a very heavily capitalized industry to get into to start with. And now if you take out all those pieces of equipment that as a new company you can buy to start out to get rolling to where you can afford new equipment, it'll just be almost impossible because the valuation of equipment that's 2007 model year and newer, it's a big jump. Restricting the purchase of a 2006 and newer, if we do that, it's going to immediately devaluate every construction company in the state of Oregon because I no longer can sell that piece of equipment in the state of Oregon unless I sell it to a logger or a farmer. Otherwise, I have to ship it out of state. And so our business is based on, especially people like myself that work in public works, we have to bond everything we do. And our bonding is strictly based off our assets and our working capital, our money in the bank. And that would immediately be impacted the day this passes if it's we're restricted from selling our equipment in the state of Oregon because it's now devalued because now we have to ship it out of state to be able to get rid of it. And so that'd be a huge hit. And I'll give you an example. Currently, I've been in business 3 years, as I stated. I have 19 off-road diesel pieces of equipment. They're valued at $607,000. Ten of those pieces of equipment are 2006 and older. But out of that, that makes up $410,000 of the $607,000 that I own. And so it's a big chunk of it. And the reason it's big because it's cranes. It's large pieces of equipment that are really expensive to buy. If I'd go buy a new crane equal to the one that I currently own, it'd cost me $1.5 million to buy one piece of equipment. But if I went out and looked at, okay, I'm just going to upgrade to 2007 and newer for those 10 pieces of equipment, it would cost me $1.1 million to replace that equipment. And so a company that's just starting out trying to do something like that, you're never going to be able to get rolling because you can never afford to capitalize it and do that. And it's also going to kill small business in the fact of that the big companies that are multi-state, they'd strictly cycle their equipment. They'll move the old stuff out of Oregon, bring the new stuff in. They'll take the dirty stuff out of Oregon, and they'll go use it in other states that don't have a policy. So now you're penalizing all the small guys that can't do that. So the bigger guys can just cycle their stuff with very little cost. It's a transportation cost to shift things around. Small company can't do that. You have to replace that piece of equipment. Another thing, too, to really consider is if we're looking at this, California phase, there was a 14-year phase-in period. Because it's such a big piece of a company, the valuation of your equipment, so that you more or less – most of the smaller businesses had 14 years to transition, to get rid of their older stuff, and to do retrofits and upgrade. And so it's a long process. And so we obviously have to look at that. Registration is a piece of this currently as it sets. I guess for me personally, look at dollars and cents. I would not understand why the state would turn around if we're going to go into registration and have DEQ do a registration when we already have DMV who obviously is set up to register things, vehicles. And so it's a lot easier to set up DMV to do something like this versus DEQ. So that'd be my first thing on the registration. The second one is, what's the value of the registration? What are we going to do with it? As we heard Senator Dembro talk earlier, he stated that we'd only be registering the older pieces of equipment. And I guess, so is that strictly to track when they're getting out? I guess I would challenge that because the bill doesn't read that way. The bill reads we're going to register all equipment. And so I guess that's a whole new thing based on what your testimony was as far as what we're registering and how we're tracking. One thing, I guess, being part of the committee, in 2016, I personally was diagnosed with cancer. I went through a chondrosarcoma operation to have the cancer removed up at OHSU. And being in the middle of this and obviously looking at cancer in the eye, my personal self, I dug in and started researching this on my own because it impacted me directly. I initially... obviously, we're very fortunate in Oregon to have OHSU so close to us. We have some of the leading cancer doctors in the U.S. right here in Oregon. And so I began to talk to my doctor about causes. Obviously, it was a surprise to me. I had a dad pass away from cancer in 2014, but he was a smoker. It's kind of like you expected it when it came about. But I've never smoked a day in my life. And to have cancer hit me, it's like, okay, what's going on? What's causing this? My doctor responded to me and told me to go look at a documentary called Forks Over Knives. And he said, just watch that and you'll understand. And I guess I challenge all of you guys to go watch the documentary called Forks Over Knives. And it's all about what we eat as Americans. It's not about what we're breathing that's causing a lot of these cancers and lung disease or heart disease. It's about what we're eating. And it's proven over 30 years with not only clinical trials, but actually human trials. And you can see the data yourself as you go through it. And so I continued to research, and I jumped in and started looking at diesel emissions to see. Obviously, we're having a work group. We're hearing a lot of things about people spouting stuff about health effects of diesel emissions. I obviously work in the industry. I've never felt an impact from diesel emissions myself. Obviously, if I'm standing in a plume of smoke, I step to the side, and you immediately don't smell it and feel that. And so I jump online and start researching. And obviously, there's a lot of data. I can find whatever I want on the internet to support what I want to support. And so I went to the American Cancer Society and found a report done by the American Cancer Society. And I got a couple of clauses here I'll read out of this. It kind of tells the point here. The amount of diesel exhaust people are exposed to varies greatly. Measuring these exposures is not easily done because diesel exhaust is chemically complex and many parts of it also found in a lot of other sources. This is a major challenge when trying to study the health effects of diesel exhaust. The EPA classifies diesel exhaust as likely to be carcinogenic to humans. Not deadly or anything else, it's likely. The National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health is part of the CDC that studies exposures in workplace. NIOS has determined that diesel exhaust is a potential occupational carcinogen. Potential. And that's pretty strong words coming out of American Cancer Society, using words like likely, potential. But yet we're hearing people talk about it's causing cancer, it's doing these things, when the American Cancer Society cannot even specify and say that it is. And so that's the biggest thing about diesel particulate. It's deciphering what's diesel particulate and what is something else. A lot of research needs to be done on that because right now there's not a lot of information out there showing that what is directly diesel emission particulate in the air. And so I guess that's my thing here is that we know some things that are causing cancer, and the studies show that by changing what people are eating, they can reverse cancer, and it's proven. And we're spending a lot of time chasing something and spending millions and millions and millions of dollars. In our estimation is over $300 million in this state alone to replace stuff that's older than 2007. And that's a very, very, very easily thing to hit there. And so I guess I would much rather go chase something that we know is causing cancer, know is causing health effects that we can change. We don't know that diesel is causing all these things. We're making a lot of hypotheticals. Right. And I think that's my biggest thing that I think learning going through this process myself is looking at what are the true facts and what are the costs associated with those facts. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. And we may have some questions for you. I want to thank you for your service on the work group. It was very helpful. Mm-hmm. I do want to say with respect to the cancer, I suspect that with respect to the nutritional basis of cancer, that's just as controversial as is the diesel. You know, I mean, I think you'll probably find a lot of people who will object to those facts as well.
Well, I think if you watch a documentary and you get into it and they actually show you.
Yeah.
I mean, there's pretty strong clinical information out there on it.
Right. Thanks. Cody, you want to go next?
Yes. Thanks. Chair Dembro and committee, my name is Cody White. Thank you for allowing me to submit testimony today. This is my first testimony submittal or whatever you guys call it. My family operates a small trucking company and a custom farming operation. We provide jobs to approximately 45 employees at our peak time in the middle of the summer. We're located just here in Polk, or I guess just in Polk County, right there in the Rickreall area. We bring in bulk feed and grain from the rail, and we deliver it to dairies, feed mills, and other facilities. And we also harvest hay and forage for dairies and other farms. We travel basically the I-5 corridor into Washington, over into the Yakima Valley, and then we go down into Crescent City, California. So just into the tip. Senate Bill 108 would be detrimental to our business. We're considered a for-hire ag business or farm business, so our ag business would be affected by Senate Bill 1008 as well as our hauling company. 20 of our trucks are pre-95. A few of them are the original vehicles that my grandparents purchased back in the early 70s when they started our business. We're still running those. 28 of them are 1996 to 2006 models. and then we have other farm equipment that this doesn't apply to. But only one of our 49 trucks is post-2007, and so basically we would have to replace or retrofit almost every truck that we own. Just rough cost to replace some of the older trucks, you're looking at least $40,000 a unit, and then to retrofit, you're anywhere from $7,000 to $14,000. So, I mean, that adds up really fast. You're $1 million or more just for our company. I mean, obviously rough numbers. We are not in a high profit business, and we cannot incur all of these state mandated costs. This bill hits businesses hard that are least able to absorb this cost. Mainly it hits small businesses and family farms. That's just two examples. We're directly tied to the dairy industry, and if you guys have ever talked to a dairyman, you know that they're always broke. So we can't really just charge more money. We're limited in that. Though it may not seem like we are trying to help with emissions, we do our best. Every few years we cycle newer trucks into our lineup. Coming out of a recession that we just went through, it's hard to get your bearings and get back on your feet after something like that. So the new technology just hasn't been financially feasible for us right now. The way that our truck, our cycling works is roughly every five or so years we go through and we buy maybe four or five new trucks, and we wait for the line trucks, the Walmart trucks, the May trucking trucks to come on the market, and we purchase the ones that they sell or lease returns, that kind of thing. So we're not paying $130,000, $150,000 for a new unit. We're paying $50,000 or $60,000. It's more affordable for us. So like I said, coming out of the recession and kind of getting back going, it just takes time to be able to get things moving, and it also takes time for them to put the 500 or so thousand miles on their units so that we can purchase them and kind of decrease our emissions as well. I urge you not to pass this regulation on an industry that basically you guys that was just recently passed an increase in fuel costs through the low carbon fuel standard, and we're not even sure how that's really gonna take shape. We're also looking at a possible gas tax in the upcoming transportation package. Our diesel dependent trucking business is getting better. It just takes time, so we're trying to fix the situation. Like I said, we're purchasing trucks with more strict emission controls when we can, but can't replace our entire fleet at one fail swoop. Companies like ours trying to practice fiscal responsibility and using equipment for its usable life are already doing their part to prevent environmental impacts on our society. And I would rather not just throw usable equipment away. If you look at the, I guess, a more large effect, you would see that there's a very large carbon footprint and also other emissions associated with producing replacement equipment. And other states would, I guess, just have to deal with that. But, I mean, there's a lot of other impacts of doing that. So if you must pass Senate Bill 1008, I hope you will also take a few thoughts into consideration. I read in the bill or the summary that you guys are looking at doing refuse recycling trucks that are kind of doing those ones first. But a lot of those vehicles are owned by companies that have they make okay money. They're more, I guess, better positioned financially to be able to do their own replacements and retrofits, as well as using the 1% of the state-funded construction bond projects on the companies that are doing the construction for the state. And they're also kind of the cream of the crop when it comes to construction companies, and they're cycling equipment out every few years, where a company like ours or smaller companies cannot absorb this cost. It would be great if the state would help smaller companies before they help the ones with deep pockets. Thank you.
Thank you, Cody. Thank you for your testimony. And that is our goal, I will say. Just a quick question. When it does come time for you to replace one of your trucks to, cycle over, how hard would it be to replace it with a truck that was built after 2007?
The older trucks that we run on our farm side, the tough part is they're only worth about $5,000 or $7,000, and we put seasonal employees in them, so we don't want to invest a lot of money because they're seasonal employees, and they're difficult on equipment. It would be roughly $40,000 a unit, because a new motor and a retrofit on that would, I mean, it's a per unit basis.
Right, but I mean, as you buy a new truck, What year would it be that you would be buying?
Well, we traditionally, I mean, in this situation, we would buy post-2007. Right. Because our other units, they're just pre, they're like 2004s or so. Yeah. And so whichever ones come off the line, we get a group of good line trucks with relatively low miles.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mark.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association and the Oregon Public Ports Association. I want to commend Senator Dembro and members of the work group. Certainly a commendable goal that you're trying to achieve, and I have no quibble with the goal. However, the execution contained in 1008 does present a few problems for the membership that I am here to represent today. In particular, Section 4, dealing with the 1%, Mr. Eliason covered that very well, and I don't need to pile on there. I would note, though, that in that particular section of the proposal, there is an exemption for small special districts. I would submit that it might be wise to just exempt all special districts, and I don't have to participate here. So I also like to express some concerns requiring
do the other interests in the room agree to that? Do I have a thumbs up? Yeah? No.
Sorry. Well, I thought I'd give it a shot, right? also like to express concerns about registration for 25 horsepower or more for non-roadway equipment. Special districts do a lot of moving of water, a lot of backup generators, so on and so forth. Oftentimes, these generators aren't being operated unless the power goes out. You're very familiar with one in particular, Multnomah County Drainage District, for example. So that's a life safety issue there. You've got to have your backup power ready in those situations. I'd also tell you that ports operate a lot of non-road diesel equipment. And in fact, our fire districts, interestingly, a lot of our small rural fire districts get hand-me-downs from other more, shall we say, wealthy fire departments throughout the state. In fact, I did a quick little poll. We have actually one. I was having a little competition. One of the oldest fire apparatuses that is a diesel operated apparatus dates back to 1971 for a very, very small fire district, and it's still operational for that district, and it's very valuable to that community. Finally, I just quickly mention, I would say that we don't oppose doing an inventory. I'm concerned about the way it's done in the bill with DEQ doing it and causing a registration fee, so on and so forth. I think that there is some merit to doing a third-party inventory. So we're not opposed to doing an inventory. I just want to make that clear. And then finally, I'm certainly concerned about Section 19 dealing with the California non-roadway standard being implemented. Obviously, there's a lot of equipment used to maintain various infrastructure for the members that I represent. That would be prohibitively costly for many of them. And with that, I would say we have no quibble with the VW settlement and how you propose to roll that out. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mark. Just to clarify, your concern about the registration,
yes,
would be what?
Would be a fee and having DEQ deploy that. Again, it just seems in this instance where it would be our members would have to be paying DEQ for the purposes of registering this type of equipment with, as the gentleman to my left said, with no understandable outcome for that registration to take place. Again, we have no problem with an inventory being taken place to get a sense for how large the problem is, but we are not necessarily too delighted about the prospect of DEQ doing that.
So then would you prefer more like a periodic inventory? You know, every few years, something like
certainly
that.
Certainly, from our perspective, if the state feels compelled that this is an important enough issue to do an inventory and do it on a regular cycle, then the state ought to pay for it. It shouldn't be coming out of local government coffers.
Right, but local governments are the emitters here.
In some cases, indeed.
Okay. Senator Rogan.
So my only thing is,
all of our small districts and all these companies are doing inventories. I mean, the federal government now requires anything that's of a certain value to have an inventory. So you've probably got the inventory.
Probably do have the
So the issue will just be you want just this part of the inventory. So, I mean, I would hope that we understand that there are ways to maybe get some of this information, at least from public units, much easier, quicker way without having to have registration. So if our goal is to find out what we have, right. I think there are ways
there are methods.
In which we might
public
be able
records
to,
is
public
a,
records
perfect,
is already
perfect
there.
Example.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. And we have talked to ODOT. ODOT already has a lot of information, and they would work with the third party who's doing the inventory, and we believe that that could really reduce the cost of this.
Right. Terrific. And again, it's really the cost from our perspective. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Okay, our last prepared panel, we have Mike Buckantz on the phone, where he's been patiently waiting through fire drills and everything. And we have Michael Streichspear, who's come up from California. So why don't we start with you, Mike, on the phone.
Thank you, Senator Denver. I appreciate the opportunity to be a part of this process and to offer this testimony. I'm glad to hear that there'll be somebody else who has Ground Zero California experience offering testimony today. I was fearful that I might be the only one, but Associates Environmental has been involved in the California process since its inception and has followed your process closely and have helped countless clients deal with the California regulation. I need to testify against SB 1008 for the following reasons. SB 1008 is unlikely to have the intended impact of lowering diesel emissions. And the reason for it is that the technologies that SB 1008 seeks to employ quickly are already in the market and have been for several years. The cleanest on-highway engines, the 2010 engines, have been available for 7 years or more and have pretty robust market penetration. The cleanest off-road vehicles have been available for 2 to 4 years already, and by the time the registration program would kick in, these same engines will have been in place and in the market for 5 to 7 years. EPA and California are not currently seeking to advance additional manufacturers' emission reduction regulations on diesel engines, and that indicates to me that they view the current standards as sufficient to achieve even California's regulatory goals, and as many of your folks have indicated today as they've testified, Oregon doesn't have the non-attainment problems that California does. I've seen no evidence that the dumping of quote-unquote non-compliant engines has happened in Oregon or that it will happen. First of all, I'm not sure what the term non-compliant means in the state of Oregon at this point, since I'm not aware of significant in the off-road arena restrictions on use of diesel engines. The state of the economy, at least the last several years, suggests that the used equipment market in Oregon has really not been robust. And further, to the extent California contractors have sought to rid themselves of older equipment, that process is already complete. The biggest teeth in the California portion of the regulation have already been. That part of the process is over. The regulation of diesel engines in California has really stalled the economic recovery in California as contractors choose between hiring employees and spending outside of a normal equipment replacement cycle. So they're choosing between expanding their business and hiring new folks or buying a piece of equipment that they otherwise wouldn't buy to replace something that they wouldn't otherwise replace. And I see that as a problem, and I see that as forestalling the economic recovery. We help contractors deal with this regulation all the time, and we are forever helping them make choices about what useful asset that's easy to bond that they have to get rid of versus something that really, for all intents and purposes, they wouldn't buy if not for this regulation. I do support the creation of a robust diesel emission inventory, as you've heard me say many, many times throughout this process. It needs to cover all sectors of the Oregon economy so that it can be determined whether a problem does, in fact, exist. And if know what the significant contributors to the problem are. And until that inventory has been developed, we simply don't know. The registration program in California has been cumbersome. It has been costly to the state, and they do not charge a registration fee to the contractors to get registered in the state. I'm not sure that anybody knows the exact cost of the registration program, but there is a system of computer programs and online certification in place and issuing of equipment identification numbers. It's not inexpensive, and it is a continuing recurring cost to the state each year, and it also creates a compliance burden on the state to weed out folks that haven't registered from folks that, that have. So it's not just the cost of a registration program, it's a cost of enforcing against those that, that haven't participated in the registration program. I do appreciate the committee's work. I appreciate the effort that the state is undertaking and the consideration that, that they're giving to these issues. And I will appreciate any questions that you have, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mike. Let's hear from Michael first.
Yeah, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Michael Strikespear. I'm the CTO of ESW Group, and I appreciate the opportunity to comment on the proposed diesel, clean diesel regulation on and off-road heavy-duty diesel engines. Also want to thank you, Senator Dembrough, for your leadership in crafting this bill and bringing stakeholders together through work groups. I think that's really important. ESW Group is a U.S.-based company with a strong presence in California. We hold 9 CARB retrofit verification, system verifications, and are very familiar with the California diesel emission controls market. As a manufacturer of diesel particulate filters, or DPFs, we're also participating in the aftermarket business outside of California. Based on our 15-year experience with diesel emission controls technology and regulation, we believe that SB 1008 will produce significant air quality benefits for communities in Oregon. We believe the proposed bill is technically sound, ensures that dangerous ultrafine particulate are efficiently captured by requiring diesel particulate filters to be used, has sufficient safeguard for end users, provides a solid funding path to speed up implementation, and is sufficiently flexible for end users to meet compliance. In addition, the initial focus on school buses and vehicles that operate in residential neighborhoods ensures that the program will provide immediate health benefit. As a possible future consideration could be the development of an effective and economical inspection and maintenance program. After all, clean diesel regulations don't mean much if the filters are broken. We're also pleased to see that retrofit is one of the technology options to reach compliance. And I want to focus the rest of my statement on retrofit DPF systems, which are not always well understood. Retrofit DPF systems are a mature technology with a variety of systems applied over more than a decade. Retrofit DPF systems provide a highly cost-effective option to those who don't have the resources to replace a truck or a bus or switch to natural gas. Currently, an installed retrofit system costs approximately $8,000 to $13,000. This comparatively low-cost option can provide an affordable path to compliance for smaller fleets, for example. The required maintenance on retrofit systems is roughly equivalent to that of an emission control system of a model year 2007-2009 engine, and is less complicated than 2010 model year engine. We also applaud the requirement that only EPA and CARB verified DPF retrofit systems are allowed. Verification protects the end user by making sure that the products have been through rigorous evaluation by an independent government agency and are backed by a warranty. Since 2003, CARB has verified more than 20 on and numerous off-road diesel PM retrofit systems. In response to the on and off-road regulations and various incentive programs, over 58,000 retrofit systems have been utilized in California alone, many of which are still in operation today. So in short, we're pleased to testify in support of SB 1008 It's well thought out. It's a well thought out approach to meet Oregon's air quality goals and protect public health in the most timely, cost-effective way possible. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Michael, and thank you for coming all this way. Do you have questions for either of our Californians, gentlemen? Senator?
I guess I'm not really sure if this is the time to be asking. It sounds to me the type of filters that are being proposed in the bill are been proven to be superior compared to the others, and so I'm just not up to speed on that. I'm just wondering.
Yeah, Michael maybe can help with this. One of the things that we came to learn over the course of the work group was that the technology for retrofits has matured, and in its early days there were some issues, particularly with respect to construction equipment, that largely seems to have been addressed. And
Chair Dembro, Senator Prozanski, yeah, there. Perhaps the industry hasn't done a very good job in providing all the information, but there are different kinds of devices that often are all thrown into this under the label filters. But there is what is called a diesel particulate filter, which is a true filter where all the gases have to go through a porous wall, and there are other devices which are flow-through devices, and that under this description would be, for example, diesel oxidation catalyst. And to capture the dangerous ultrafine particles that are in the nanometer scale, 10 to 100 nanometers, using a flow-through device is a little bit like using a chicken wire fence for a fly screen. So that's why we are always concerned when they're all listed together, but there's a distinct difference. And to really get the impact, you want to use a filter.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, Michael. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Robler.
On the phone, I just wanted to, you caught me a little by surprise when you said that because of the efforts that have already been made and the fact that trucks are changing and so on and the market is pretty much there, that passage of the bill would not really have much effect on diesel emissions in our state. Is that because the industry is already going that way and that the number of diesel things that before 27 are rapidly getting out of the system? Why was that your comment made about it would have very little effect on the air quality? If you're still there.
I think it'll have very little effect on the air quality because I think that the low hanging fruit is already coming out of the system. The fuel economy of the newer equipment is superior, and I think the contractors are doing what they've always done. They're making sage decisions based on the market and on the economy and on the state of their own businesses. We see this in the on-road world all the time. We got sulfur out of gasoline. That enabled catalytic converters. Catalytic converters got better over time. Emission standards came down over time. And as the market allowed those new on-road vehicles to penetrate the market, the emissions from on-road vehicles have come down drastically in spite of great growth in vehicles on the road, great growth in population. The difference between that and what we're asking of the diesel world, we've now gotten sulfur out of diesel fuel for the most part. It's enabled some catalytic technologies that have been employed by manufacturers. Those technologies are now penetrating the market. The difference is when we did this on the gasoline side, nobody said, take your 1967 Mustang to the scrapyard and crush it. That's what we're telling contractors to do. We've seen from real world examples that letting the market and these technologies employ will result in reduced emissions. We're asking contractors to commit unnatural acts to choose equipment that they don't need to replace over employees that they need to do work. And I think that's where the fundamental difference is, and that's why I believe that, A, because of the climate, Oregon's not going to have an off-road or on-road diesel regulation that's going to force new equipment into the market anytime in the next 2 or 3 years. That is a certainty. By the time we get to that point, if we ever do, and I hope we don't, that equipment's already going to be in the market. The job's going to be done.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Okay. And Mike, I just want to clarify before you were wondering what I meant by non-compliant equipment. What I meant was non-compliant under the new federal standards that have been in place since 2007, 2010. I could use the term older.
Clarification, but, yeah. Senator, I would only add to that the new federal standards didn't make an existing engine non-compliant. It just meant that new engines coming off the assembly line needed to meet the new standard.
Okay, we're quibbling, but thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll stop quibbling. Well. Great. Thank you for the opportunity, okay. Senator.
Yeah. Senator Roblin,
yeah, just one last question. I know that much of our ocean-going fleet that brings stuff here is running off bunker fuel, which probably has some of the same kinds of problems. We heard Vigor talk about they make them plug in, and I think we're getting more and more of that in. Will this bill affect that industry? Are those ships going to have to figure out a way to convert, or are they going to whatever?
Yeah,
because I don't know how we convert them.
No, they're not included in this.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Okay. So, sorry, everyone, how long this has taken, but it's been, I think, rich testimony. I can stay till 5:30. So we have gone through our prepared panels. We have some people who've signed up. And let's see if we can get to them till 5:30. And certainly, gentlemen, if you have to leave.
Yeah, 5:30, 100 miles. I'm going to check on
that. We're through with our 100 miles. So let's hear from James Barta and Marilyn Kernitzer and Mary Pivito, please. And if you all could be just like 2 minutes, that would really be great. Thank you. Sorry. Mary, you want to start? Or James? James, let's start with the kids.
Let's start with the children. My name is James Bard. I'm the legislative director for Children First for Oregon, and we have the Children's JETA with United for Kids. And obviously, we're working to support policies to improve the health and safety of children, and we believe Senate Bill 1008 does exactly that. And, I've been watching the discussion with interest, and I just want to point out that in my written testimony, which I only submitted a little while ago, so we'll be on all this tomorrow, we talk about a lot of the research that demonstrates the danger of diesel emissions. But just as a separate point that I think people will understand is Volkswagen would not have settled for $14.7 billion unless this was a terrible thing that happened. And so I don't think there's any doubt that diesel emissions are dangerous, that children are particularly susceptible. And then, as the Oregonian had an article that pointed out, more than half of the school bus fleet in the state runs on engines built before 2007. And so I appreciate Section 9 in the bill that allows these school buses a little more time to get these needed retrofits to make it easier, and that the bill as a whole is important for children's health in these corridors where they experience more diesel pollution, and it affects those who are the most vulnerable. I love the term children are like hummingbirds. They breathe more per weight, and they have more lung surface area, so they're particularly susceptible. So I can talk more about the research, but that's in my written testimony. I appreciate the work of the work group, and I want to point out that this is a children's agenda item. Of course, it has support from health groups, from environmental groups, but also other groups like the Oregon Center for Christian Voices, League of Women Voters, recognize that this is an important concept. And again, we appreciate your work in moving forward with this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, James. Speaking of the League, Marilyn?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Kennitzer of Corvallis, League of Women Voters of Oregon. League, as you know, has positions we study from, and we adopted our position on air quality in 1968. We support regulation and reduction of pollution from stationary sources and ambient air toxic pollutants, and we support the right of states to set more stringent standards than the federal government. I'm really surprised that we really like your preamble, all the health effects in the preamble, but I'm personally surprised that in the past couple of years, articles on health of PM2.5 and diesel in particular have come out with increasing frequency, because I've been doing air pollution for a long time. There was a dearth way before that. But now diesel is, of course, now they say it's carcinogenic, so that adds more to the mix. League believes that any measures taken to help owners of dirtier diesel engines to retrofit them with particulate filters or to convert them to other technology or fuels will benefit everyone, including the people who operate the machinery. We especially like the idling provision. We also support your plan to retrofit the buses. But I had one statement in my testimony that I was questioning the time frame, the lapse of the 2007 to 2015, 2025. It seemed like a long time. So I'm not quite sure that I was correct in my assessment of that. So we could strike that if that's not reasonable. And then the final thing is that the $73 million Oregon will get from the settlement is a good start, but I think you need those fees that are seem to be the basis of everything we need now. We need to finish up the job with the cleaning the diesel pollution with the fees that you're talking about, the 1%. And that's it. I think you've done a great job. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Marilyn. Mary, welcome.
Thank you very much. For the record, Mary Pivato, I'm the president of Neighbors for Clean Air. And Chair Deborah and members of the committee, all of you who are here, and I'm really sorry that Senator Olson isn't here, because I saw his message he sent out today that he's really interested in discussion about this. But I'm happy to be here to be able to support, provide testimony in support of SB 1008. You know, frankly, it's time. This issue has been on the radar in Oregon since 2001, when the state of Oregon first recognized the harm that exhaust from diesel engines posed to the health of all of us who live in Oregon. And we've engaged in various efforts over those, 15-plus years. In fact, in 2007, when the new national diesel engine standard was required that achieved an incredible 95% reduction, consequently, Oregon's Environmental Quality Commission implemented in the state's administrative rules a mandate to reduce excess lifetime cancer risk from diesel exhaust in Oregon to no more than 1 in 1 million by 2017. Well, it's 2017. We still have 23 counties of the 36 that exceed that state health benchmark, and in the most populous counties by tens and hundreds potentially score. But there's good news. We have seen a rare opportunity during this 2017 legislative session to correct the course. In 2016, we saw an unprecedented call to action from Oregonians that were demanding that we establish health-based standards in our air emissions regulations. While the resulting Cleaner Air Oregon rulemaking process is a dealing with the industrial piece of that mandate and the very complicated effort that is taking to overhaul the air permits, it's left in your hands as the legislators to establish the health standard for diesel, the pollutant that threatens the lives and well-being of more Oregonians than any other single pollutant. This task is all the more urgent because we do know that diesel emissions are three times higher in all the census tracts, the areas where communities of color and low-income communities live. And these are populations that have been historically underrepresented in this decision-making process, in all the benefits of environmental regulations in our state. And frankly, they're paying the highest cost, though, in the health outcomes associated with these toxic emissions. So in short, it's in your hands to take the action to end what really can only be called environmental racism that exists in our current in our current system. And we ask you to stand up for the racial justice that we need to see to make sure that all people have the right to breathe clean air in Oregon. SB 1008 establishes a standard for diesel engine exhaust and, importantly, a deadline for compliance, which is exactly what's needed. And the fact that Oregon has upwards $80, $85 million from the VW diesel emissions fraud settlement to put on the table towards compliance with new emission standards for all diesel engines makes it even more clear that the moment to act on this is this year, this legislative session. So thank you very much for your support.
Thank you very much, Mary. Any questions for the panel? Okay, thank you, all three of you. Is Alex Kyler still here? No, he seems to have left. So we have, I think, two people who are still signed up. So why don't, if you could come up and just talk for a minute. Oh, wait a minute. No, there's a second sheet. I'm sorry. Never mind.
Notice how these
Never
two
mind.
People became 20.
Yeah, wow.
First one's the three seats.
Okay, then.
There she goes. Good job.
I'll take the chair.
Okay, come on up and talk to us for a minute, if you would.
Chair Dembro and committee. I'm Susan Katz. I'm a retired pediatrician from McMinnville. I'm the head of environmental health for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. I've been looking at diesel emissions and public health for quite a long time. And I do want to say quickly that I think the dangers of the health effects for diesel emissions have been underestimated by both DEQ and OHA. Our benchmark for the state is 33 times less protective than California. OHA is looking at this again, but we have a poor benchmark. And they also don't take into account all the research since 2007. I put this in the record. It was published last week by us. It's a review. And all the questions that were raised about the doubtfulness that there really are health effects from diesel are simply wrong. There's new evidence. There's new long-term prospective studies, epidemiological studies on human beings. There's no doubt anymore that you can link diesel emissions specifically because you can measure them as black carbon instead of just PM 2.5. And the evidence is that if you look at a unit of black carbon compared to a unit of PM 2.5, you probably get 4 to 9 times as much risk as all the previous studies showed. So.
Okay, thank you very much, Susan. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Vivian Christensen, and I'm a resident of Southeast Portland, and I wanted to thank you, Senator Devereaux, and the members of the committee for holding this important hearing today in order to have stronger regulations for diesel pollution in Oregon. So this is Senate Bill 1008. So we all know that diesel pollution causes cancer, cardiovascular disease, stroke, preterm birth, as well as chronic respiratory illness such as asthma. In fact, Oregon ranks among the 5 worst states in the U.S. for asthma. The impact of diesel pollution in our state has been shouldered by the residents of Oregon rather than the companies that are using outdated trucks and construction equipment. The public health costs of diesel pollution in Oregon is over $3 billion per year. I'd like to take just a minute to illustrate this point by telling you about my family's experience. As I mentioned, I live in Southeast Portland, not far from the Brooklyn Yard, which is a truck-to-train transfer facility. This is significant for several reasons. First, we're exposed to trains with diesel-polluting engines that pass through my neighborhood, and we are also exposed to the diesel exhaust from old semi-trucks that travel to and from the rail yard. Most of these trucks are what we would call gross polluters. So you've seen the black smoke that comes out from the engines, or the tailpipes, rather. And in the past few years, there's been an increase in these trucks. I don't know why, but we're seeing this in my neighborhood. My 11-year-old son was diagnosed with asthma when he was 5. My son has had to deal with missed school days, visits to the emergency room, and countless visits to his pediatrician. Each time he experiences an exacerbation with his asthma, he becomes really anxious and scared. I don't know if anyone else in this room has dealt with asthma, but not being able to breathe is truly an awful experience. I can tell you that as a parent, it is painful to watch your child suffer like this. My son's asthma has also cost our family thousands of dollars in out-of-pocket expenses for his medical care. Not hundreds, but thousands of dollars. This has also resulted in missed work days for both me and my husband. And my family is not alone in having had these types of experiences. Oddly enough, my son has never had to use his rescue inhaler even once while traveling outside of the area, outside of Oregon. This includes...
Vivian, if you could wrap up.
Sure, okay. So I'm asking you today to please consider Oregonians who suffer from chronic health conditions and the impact diesel is having on our health and economy when voting on this very important piece of legislation. It's time that we invest in clean air, as California and Washington have done, and given the funds available from the Volkswagen settlement, the time to act is now. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Dana Vissi. Thank you for this opportunity, Senator Dembrough and members of the committee. I'll be really quick. I can submit longer testimony, but Vivian and I, our children go to the same school. I'm part of the EcoSchool Network, where we work to improve green practices throughout the school districts in Oregon. I'm here really just as a parent of having two small children and seeing the effect of industrial pollution in our neighborhood, but particularly to talk about diesel today. Just 2 weeks ago, Vivian and I, with some support from Neighbors from Clean Air, started a MoveOn.org petition, and we are here to submit the signatures that we gathered. We have over 278 pages of names, which is equivalent to, we have 3,125 people that support the following petition. I'm going to read it, just the shortened version. And it goes, please support a statewide diesel standard during the 2017 legislative session to require clean diesel engines that don't cause unhealthy air pollution. Further, please fund engine upgrades. The VW settlement is the right tool for the job. Without adequate funding, old engines will linger for too many years. In these pages, there's people not just from Portland, but from Coos Bay, from Medford, from Ashland, from Otis, Lincoln City, all over the state, and they're saying the same thing, that we want this, and this is the time to do it now. We're a state that has had leadership in things like the first bottle bill, making beaches public, Oregon's state land use planning system, and we are really behind on this issue. We have a dirty diesel secret. It's really time that we as a state catch up to our neighbors, and as parents and as community members, we are here with, imagine another 3,000 people behind us saying this is what we want now. So I'm going to submit this as a testimony, and thank you for the opportunity.
Very much appreciated. Thank you very much, Dana. Okay, so we're out of time, folks. City of Portland, have you submitted testimony?
Yes, I submitted.
Okay, great. Yeah, and I think everyone else, you have, right? Yeah.
Record's still open.
Yes, and certainly you can still submit written testimony. So let me just say for people in the audience and colleagues, a number of meetings will follow this meeting, and there will be an opportunity, at least for those people who signed up, who didn't get a chance to testify, to come when we have our work session on this bill to provide some further input. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1008. And for today, we are adjourned.
So I was going to raise my hand.
And for today, we are adjourned.
So I was going to raise my hand.